So first of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me. This talk is about lattices of intermediate subvectors in finite index. The subject has been very active recently. You have heard from Dittmer's talk about intermediate subvectors, and there's a partial list of people who have worked on these things. It's a strong motivation for developing various aspects of planar algebras. So this group was strongly motivated by a talk of Ohm 3 years ago in an operator algebra program similar to this one. All right, so so this is the plan of the talk. So in the first part, it's an introduction. I'll talk about the subject of interest, what are the lattices, and second part is about realization of certain lattices. I'll explain what this M2n is as overfold of certain subfactors, which I call Jones-Westman subfactor, coming from conformal flow theory. And in the third part, I will sketch a proof. Alright, so let's get started. So the first part is about subgroup and subfactor lattices. So let me introduce some notations here. So H here is a subgroup of a group G, and I use this notation to denote all the intermediate subgroups between H and G. Okay? So K, this is a collection of elements. This set is natural lattice with two natural operations, the union and intersection. So for the intersection, you just take the intersection as a set, and that's a subgroup which contains H and is also in G. And for the union, you take the subgroup of G generated by these two subgroups. Okay? Here, there's a result of Tuma, who showed that every lattice can be realized as this subgroup lattice for some pairs of groups. So H is a subgroup G. His construction, very ingenious, but it's an infinite induction procedure. So even for finite lattices, in general, you produce infinite groups. Okay. So the question, no question in group theory, asks for the following. Can every finite lattice be realized as subgroup lattice for some finite group G? Okay, because of the result of Tuma, question only makes sense for finite group now. So I didn't find exact reference to this, but I was told was back in the 60s or probably even earlier. So now I'd like to define what's MN. Okay. It's in one of the previous transparencies. So MN lattice is a lattice consisting of the largest, the smallest, and n pairwise incomparable elements. Okay. So that's a lattice. Perhaps one of the simplest lattice around. So you can always have a largest element and the smallest element. And then you have n elements in between which are incomparable. Okay, so I use a diagram like this to represent this lattice. So most of the group theory's attempts to answer the question I mentioned before have been focused on this particular question. So whether this MN can be realized as subgroup lattice for some finite group G. Okay? So I'd like to briefly go over the results which have been obtained by group theories along this direction. So for N equal to 1, 2, Q plus 1, where Q is a prime number, it's an elementary exercise to show that MP plus 1 can be realized. Okay? So if you're bored, you can check that if you have P a prime number, you take ZP cross ZP, then all the subgroups of this product is actually MP plus 1. Okay? Next result is due to Poffy, who proved that if MN is realized as a subgroup of lattice with a finite solvable group, then the least in item 1 is all there is. Okay? So if a group is finite solvable, that's all the lattice you can get. Okay? And then Fate proved that M7 and M11 can be realized as subgroup lattice, where G is the alternating group on 31 letters. And in 94, Lucini made a breakthrough and showed that when N is equal to Q plus 2, well, I should say that for a while people thought that those are the only ones, but then he showed two infinite series. So when N is equal to Q plus 2, or N equal to QT plus 1 over Q plus 1, plus 1, where T is an odd prime, then this can be realized. Okay. So, and then can be realized as finite subgroup lattice. So the long list of N's which can be realized is the following. So this is the complete list. And you can check easily. The smallest N which is not in the list is 16. It's more complicated, so I didn't write it down. So, but it's non-trivial, so if you have somehow come across this alternating group of 31 letters, somehow realize M7 and 11. All right, so M16, so most of the work have focused on this. And let me sort of give you an idea of, you know, the work that has been done by trying to realize MN. Okay? So the starting point is, suppose he's realized. Okay? So GH realized MN. And of course, it's a finite group. You can always do induction. You can assume that the G is the smallest group with this property, okay, where you can find a subgroup so that GH is realized. So Kohler proved the following. If you assume G is the smallest element with this property, then G has a unique minimum non-abelian simple group, M. And this M is always the direct product of isomorphic non-abelian simple groups. So you see that these non-abelian simple groups have to somehow play roles in this question. And in a breakthrough by Bellamy and Lucini, in a paper, 97, this is actually a rather short paper by a group theory standard. Okay. So they proved that the list I mentioned before, which had n equal to, you know, certain prime numbers and so on, is in fact complete if one can solve a few problems in finite simple groups. Okay. So basically what they have done is to reduce the problem together with the classification of finite simple groups to a question about checking the list, because if you accept that the finite simple groups have been classified, there are a few infinite series and 26 simple groups, so you should just check them. Okay, so they have reduced the problem to check the list of finite simple groups. So I'll give you a flavor of what type of questions one has to answer. Okay. So this is one of the questions to answer they asked. So let G be a finite simple group. One needs to find all the subgroups of automorphism group of this simple group, such that there's only one non-trivial invariant subgroup of G under this automorphism group F. Okay. So this is a finite problem. But just take the monster group and try to see if you can do this. It's already quite non-trivial. Okay, we know the representation of the monster group is already quite involved. Okay? So even though this is a remarkable piece of work which has reduced the problem, you know, to a finite list, still quite complicated. So that's the group theory side. So now I'd like to talk about subfactor lattices. So I introduced the usual notation. We have a factor, and n in M is a subfactor. So in itself is a factor, and we require that this inclusion is irreducible. So n prime, the commutant of n in M is trivial, and we do similar things. Okay, so I use this. This is a bad, perhaps a bad notation, but let me use this notation to denote the set of Riemann algebras between n and M. Because this inclusion is irreducible, those Riemann algebras are automatically factors. Okay? And this is a lattice with inclusion, with intersection and union just as before. Okay? This is the, literally the intersection of two sets, and this is the Riemann algebra generated by K1 and K2. Okay? So it was implicitly proved in an old paper by Soren Popa that if the index is finite, then this set is in fact the finite set. Okay? It's also independently observed by Tani, and who actually realized all the lattices with the most five elements. Okay? However, even for lattices with six elements, so for instance, this silly one, the Hextone lattice, at that time was not clear, and Vaughan mentioned this in his talk 3 years ago. I was quite impressed by this because, you know, what can be more simpler than this lattice with a hexagon diagram? All right, so let me mention that by cross-product construction and the Galois correspondence, for every finite group, in fact, every countable group, G, this subgroup lattice can be realized as cross-product subfactor lattice. Okay? This is quite straightforward. So one can ask, as a first step, can this Hextone lattice be realized as subgroup lattice for some finite group G? Okay? And if you can do that, you answer that question I was mentioned before. But this turns out to be quite hard. I was talking to Aspa about this, and it took him quite a long time to realize to actually produce this example. Okay? So Aspa proved recently that this hexagon can be realized for a finite group of this order. Okay? It's quite a large group. In fact, he has a series of groups which realize hexagon, and this is the group with the smallest order. Okay? And in fact, even in this case, the construction is indirect. So there's no explicit construction, so that's why it's that here is the action is the action a certain way. So I have to be honest, I still couldn't quite understand exactly the action. I'm still trying. But Aspa, motivated by this question, has developed quite a few new techniques in study the subgroup lattice question. Okay, so he has two or three more preprints coming out. So when I read all this, the following question seems to be a good question. Okay? So my motivating question for this work is M16. Okay? We know that M16, remember that 16 is not in the list, right? So group series conjecturally agree that M16 is not realized by group subgroups. I have to say that routinely the very cautious in the paper, but in the end they said that, you know, it's time to abandon this caution and just say that what they want to do. So what they conjecture is the list I mentioned before is the complete list. Okay? So 16 is the smallest one which is not in that list. Okay? So the question is, can this be realized as subfact lattice? Okay? Unlike the hexagon question, this time around, the group series will not help much, right? Because of the conjecture. So I was thinking about this question for quite some time, and then I found that Grossman and James find a very interesting lattice from the so-called Goodman-Hopkins subfactor. Okay, I hope those letters look familiar to the others in the audience. So this is one of the In one of the theorems, they have this particular subfactor, if you look at the diagram, it's M6. Okay. But of course, M6 For group theorems is not very interesting because 60 equals 5 plus 1, right? So 5 is a prime. Okay? So it's realized as Z5 cross Z5. But the important thing here is that this subfactor is not a group subtype, simply because the index is not an integer. Yes, yeah, so, and automatically into the index.
Oh.
Yeah. Because if the index of H in G is finite, it automatically reduces the finite case. So that theorem doesn't apply. All right, so. My observation is that the Goodman-Hapag-June subfactor can also be understood as overflows of so-called Jones-Westman subfactors, and by playing with these things, I proved the following theorem. So M2n, this is the main theorem of this talk, says that M2n for any integer n can be realized as a subfactor lattice with finite index. So in fact, this subfactors of finite depths. Okay. They're the overflow of Jones-Westman subfactor associated with SUN at level 6n. Well, 6 is to be on the safe side, so usually for the lower n case, it would be 4n would be enough. Okay. But in order to state the theorem in general case, so I have to make the level slightly larger. So for instance, M16 can be realized by this group at some level, 48. The index in this case, as you might expect, is quite large and it's not integer. Okay. So for the rest of the talk, I'd like to schedule proof of this theorem. And so in order to do that, you see, I first have to explain what is this subfactor coming from conformal field theory, and then why do we have to take the orbifold. Okay. So this is the second part of the talk. So I like to talk about the orbifolds of Jones-Westman subfactor. I will take the loop group LSUN, the smooth map from the circle to SUN, and for each positive integer level, so-called level, the funny thing about this group is that it's an infinite dimensional group, but there are very many projected unitary irreducible representation. Okay. Now if you take pi to be such a representation, and I, a proper interval of the circle, then because it's a representation of the group, notice that Lij, here I use Lij to denote the loops with support on this interval I. I prime is the complement of I, so Lij commutes with Li prime G. Okay. So this phenomenon algebra generated by loops concentrated on I with support on I commutes with the phenomenon algebra was phenomenon algebra generated by loops with support on the complement of I, so I have this natural inclusion. Okay, so this is a subfactor, so-called Jones-Westman subfactor. Okay.
What is level K? I mean, K appears.
Well, the K implicitly containing the beta about pi. Pi is a level K irreducible representation. Yes. So Westman proved that the index, so he has a formula for the index of such inclusion. So all these are finite index, finite depths, and they generate the ring structure. The ring structure is also clear. It's what physicists have known as the Linda ring. So I want to give you an example. So I assume many of you are familiar with this. So if you take n equal to 2 and take k greater than or equal to 1, this pi, the representation will be labeled by representations of SU2. Okay? And we use spin to denote such representations. So for instance, half, spin half, is usually reserved for the vector representation of SU2. Okay? That's the two-dimensional representation. And y will denote the adjoint representation of SU2, which is dimension 3. Okay? So I want to give a gentle introduction to this class of subvectors. So I assume most of you know the Jones subvector. So this is the first series of subvectors with non-integer index. So this is the one associated with spin half representation of SU2 at level k. The index is the Fermina 4 cosine squared pi over k plus 2. Okay. And if you look at all the fusion graph of this subvector, so you take tensor of this half spin representation, look for the irreducible components, you get the A graph like this. Okay? So you can read out the fusion rules. So bring down the fusion rules. So for instance, if you half fuse with yourself, what does this graph tell you? Well, the graph tells you that if you fuse with half, you get 0 and 1. So you look for the ones adjacent to half, and that's the irreducible components of this product. The next one is 1. So you fuse 1 with half, you get the ones adjacent to 1, you get half and 3 over 2. Okay? And those subfactors labeled by those representations will be the reduced subfactor of iteration of Jones subfactors. Okay? Notice that this fusion graph has a symmetry. Okay? The symmetry is just the folding of this graph. So map I goes to k over 2 minus I. Okay? And this folding can be generalized. So I'm talking about the case SU2, right? So the folding generates a Z2 symmetry. For the higher rank case, so SUN, there's a similar symmetry, the Dinkin diagram symmetry, and would be Zn in general. So I give you an example for the simplest n equal to 2, the symmetry is C2. Okay? So this is the class of interesting subfactors coming from homomorphic theories. Okay, so there have been a lot of work done in this area. Okay? However, for our purpose, remember we want to produce intermediate subfactors. The previous class of subfactors do not have very interesting intermediate subfactors in general. So for this, I introduced the following notion, Guilt-Wall. So we say a subfactor is maximal if there's no intermediate subfactor between them. Okay, so this is it corresponds to the notion of maximal subgroup, for instance. Okay? So a theorem, which is a byproduct of the proof of the main theorem, is that suppose you stay away from certain levels. Then all this factor, the Jones-Weissmann factor, is a maximum if and only if pi is not fixed by a non-trivial element in the Dinkin diagram symmetry. Okay? So let me go back to a equal to 2 and see what the theorem says. Okay? So it basically tells you that most of those pi's are maximum because the Dinkin diagram symmetry, it's a very small symmetry. So for instance, back to example n equal to 2, I have the list of those subfactors. The theorem says that when k is greater than 2, pi is maximum if and only if pi stays away from the middle point, which is the fixed point under the C2 symmetry. Okay? So in particular, when k is odd, all these pi's are maximum. Okay? Alright, so that's not a good place to look for your example. So the next one is these subfactors, there's some subfactors, it was actually known even in the early days of subfactor theory that there's some subfactors related to these ones, but whose fusion diagram contains more interesting branching and ending points. Okay? So I'll give you an example of E6 and D7 subfactor. Okay? If you look at the E6, you see it has an interesting branching ending point. So these are thick dots here. You see, it's a branching point, but it also connected to one end point. Okay, this is what I call the branching ending point. So similarly here, I have a branching point and two end points, like this. Okay? So this D even and E6 subfactor can be understood as induced from the Jones subfactor. Okay. So it's a result of work on related questions. So for instance, if you take SU2 at level 10, there's a conformal inclusion. So it's embedded in spin 5. And if you take the Jonestown factor induced by this inclusion, so this is like induction restriction, like the classical case will have you have a subgroup and a bigger group, you do the induction, then the fusion graph of this one is E6. Okay? Similarly, if you take SU2 at level 4K and you take the super extension, which I denoted by SO3, okay, then there's also induction like this, and the fusion graph gives you this, okay, which contains more interesting branching ending points. Okay. Why are these branching ending points interesting in producing intermediate subfactors? Well, maybe before I do that, let me just give you a more precise version of the theorem I stated earlier. So for A equal to 2, we know you have two, right? Two ending points. And for general N, you'll get something like this. There's interesting branching ending point like AU here indicated, and the N end points all point towards AU. Okay? So the more precise version of the theorem I stated earlier is that the subfactor which realizes M2N is actually AUM. Okay? This MAUM realizes M2N. So that particularly that branching point. So for instance, for A equal to 2, you will realize M4. Okay? Alright, so this is a more precise version of the theorem. Tells you exactly which subfactor realizes at M2N. In general, this subfactor has pretty large index, but nevertheless, it's finite depths. All right, so the last part of the talk. How much time do I have? 20 minutes. Okay. So the last part of the talk is I want to sort of sketch the ideas of the proof. I think the ideas of the proof actually even more interesting. Because along the way, we sort of produce a few other things. So here's a sketch. So I want to get back to A equal to 2, and I assume that most of you have sort of seen the Jonestown factor before, so that's the basic one. So for A equal to 2 case, remember the theorem tells you have to see M4, right? M2N, okay? And A equal to 2 now, so I have to see M4, okay? So I look more precisely at this D-even diagram. Okay. It has the interesting branching ending points here, okay, which is denoted by A 2k minus half. Notation suggests that this is the subfactor induced from this reduced Jones subfactor labeled by 2k minus half. Okay. What does a fusion graph mean? Well, fusion graph means is, you know, this is a fusion graph, so it encodes the multiplication rules. Okay. So this is where you see why the endpoints are important, because you immediately see that A2k minus half, it can be written in two different ways. One is B1 multiplied by half, the other one is B2 multiplied by A half. Okay? And you immediately see the intermediate subfactor B1m. Okay? Because m contains bi, actually I equal to 1, 2. Okay? Because bi A half m equal to A2k minus half m. Okay, so by definition, BIM contains BIA half M, and that's equal to A2K minus half M. So this is the intermediate subfactor here. Okay? So that counts for, well, I have to show why B1 is different from B2. You know, you might have these two, actually, you know, they may be the same as a subfactor between these two. So I want to show these two is different. And the idea is this. Suppose they're the same. This means these two endomorphisms have the same range. So in this case, B2 inverse B1 makes sense now. Okay, remember this endomorphism necessarily one-to-one map, and if they have the same range, B2 inverse B1 makes sense. Okay? And it's necessarily an automorphism. Okay? Because B1 and B2 have the same index. Okay? So by the fusion rules of BI, so maybe I should write one more line here. So I'll explain why these two must be different as subfactors. So I have shown that if B1m equal to B2m, then B1 equal to B2 B2 inverse B1M. Okay? Where this is an automorphism. Change my pen. Alright? So I introduced the following notation. For two endomorphism, I use this following notation. Okay, so in general, okay, so let's say alpha, let's say rho 1, rho 2 belongs to endomorphism of M. I introduce the following notation, rho 1 and rho 2 equal to the dimension of all the intertwiners between rho 1 and rho 2. Okay. So when they have finite indexes, space has finite dimension. Okay. And then there's a so-called Frobenius duality telling you, for instance, if you have rho 1, rho 2, rho 3, that's the same as rho 2, and just take rho 1 bar, rho 3. Okay? This is so-called Frobenius duality. It's the generalization of the usual Frobenius duality, okay, but now in this endomorphism context. Now let's see why from this we get a contradiction. The reason is, suppose that B1 is equal to B2, let me denote this automorphism by alpha, then by Frobenius duality, let's work through this line. It's very simple. B1, B2, alpha is going to be equal to, I use Frobenius duality, perhaps using B2 conjugate, or I should say that rho 1 bar here means the conjugate of this endomorphism. Okay? So B2 conjugate B1, alpha. Okay? So it tells you that, so this has to be equal to 1. So this tells you that B2 conjugate composes B1 has to contain an automorphism. In fact, contains this automorphism with multiplicity 1. Okay? But we know the fusion rules of these things. It doesn't contain any sector with index 1. Okay? So that's a contradiction. It shows that these two subfactors are in fact different. Okay? So let's see the progress we have made so far. For n equal to 2, we have shown that by looking at the endpoint, there are at least two subfactors, B1, B2 there, right? We need to count in the other two because we're supposed to get 4.
I have a question.
Yes.
Isn't the B1
times
A1 half the same as
A1 half times B1? Yes, but it's not the same. There's a unitary. Yes, that's exactly, you're anticipating what I'm going to talk about next. Okay, so that's exactly how you count the other two. Okay, so I have the B1, B2 now. Now let's get the other two. So the other two comes from breeding. Okay, so this endomorphism, BIA half, in fact, a commute. Okay. So the sectors are the same, but as endomorphism, there's a unitary element, which in fact comes from breeding, so that BIA half is at UI. This is adjoint action of unitary element A half BI. Okay? So by the same argument, you need to see that at UI A half M, A half, this one, gives you another pair of intermediate subfactors. Okay? So the other one comes from this breeding. Okay? And but now I have to do the same thing, right? I have to show these two are different, but it's the same type of argument because we know the fusion rules among these things. So if you multiply them, you find there are no factor with index 1 with no automorphism, then they're different. In fact, I have to show more. I have to show these two also different from the previous two. But that's also the same type of argument. Right? So what we have shown by using the known fusion rules is that this M2N, well, I have shown M4, is in fact in this set. Okay. And the same argument, exactly the same argument, shows M2N is also contained in this set. Okay. So the difficult part of the proof is actually to show that it contains no other elements. Okay. So I want to give you a rough idea of how one does this. So suppose there is an intermediate subfactor between M and this AUM. We know there are 2N of them already. And I want to identify this M1 with the 2Ns I've already found. Okay? All the sub-factors involved in this case are hyperfinite type 3-1 factors, so they're isomorphic, thanks to Wolfe's result. So we choose an isomorphism between M and M1. Okay? So this will give you an endomorphism, because M1 is in M. Okay? Alright, so what I'm going to do is, I'm going to do the same thing. Because AUM is containing the range of C1, I can take the inverse. By writing this, my AU is C1 composed with C2. We're both C1, C2 endomorphism. Okay. Same type of ideas before. Okay. So these things have been, even though it's very simple observation, but has been used, for instance, by Lungo. So our goal is to identify the C1M with the known ones. So what I've done now is, just by general nonsense, I have written my, if you have intermediate subfactor M1, then implies that my AU, which is well studied, can be written as C1 composed with C2. Okay? But even though AU is well studied, C1, C2 can be anything. Right? As you can see that the C1, because we only know M1, C1, if you take any automorphism, C1 would change, right, as an endomorphism. So this is rather, basically probably wouldn't be able to go much further. But the basic idea is that since you have this formalism, you can multiply a lambda to multiply C1 on the left, okay, and to examine the irreducible pieces of this composition, a lambda times C1. Why do you do this? So for instance, if this C1 is indeed A half, okay, one of the ones we know already there, then A half times A half would necessarily produce 1, because half times half contains the identity factor. So we would then see irreducible pieces in the decomposition. Okay? So my way of saying this is that to visualize this is by shooting this using this A lambda, which are well known, by shooting C1 with this A lambdas and look for the irreducible pieces, you might hope to see what C1 is made of. Okay? In fact, if the theorem were true, you would be able to see those small index sectors, like index 1, which is automorphism. Okay? So if the theorem were true, by looking at irreducible pieces coming from this action, you should be able to pick up very small index subfactors. In fact, they're frequently just index 2 or index 1. Okay? So this is the goal. Once you realize those ones, then it's there. This idea actually works very easily for the n equal to 2 case. For a very simple reason, because in the n equal to 2 case, we have ADE classification of norm less than 2 graphs. Okay. So the difficulty comes in when the rank is higher. And of course, for the theorem to be interesting, we have to get M16, right? So N has to be at least 8. Okay. So and the ADE classification is not available. Okay, in this case, as soon as norm is greater than 2, you have infinite many graphs with exactly the same spectrum. So the way to detect this small index subfactor, this is a bit tricky. I didn't explain what this S matrix is. Okay, so there's a TQFT associated with this this thing. So there is a S matrix which is associated with this diagram, where there's two labeled by lambda mu, which are representations. Okay, one interesting thing about S matrix is that it takes extreme value if and only if this mu is an automorphism. In other words, it has index 1. Okay. So S matrix, the message I want to get out here is that the entries of this S matrix can detect small index subfactors. In this case, in fact, the automorphisms. But remember this C1. I mentioned before, right? C1, its range is M1, but C1 is not good. So there are problems with this idea. C1 is not graded, okay, in general. you can apply any automorphism to C1 that immediately destroy the braiding structure. Okay? But the relative braidings coming from induction. Okay? So the idea is instead of previous diagram we have lambda mu, now we have to be more it's slightly different. Okay, it's more intricate. You still have braiding, but there are two relative braidings. So the additional complication is coming from this intertwiner between A lambda and A lambda tilde. Okay, in general, this is not identity. In the previous case, these are identities, but these are different. Okay, so A lambda tilde is defined in a similar way as A lambda, but use the opposite braiding. Okay? So what I want to do is I want to use these entries as matrix-like quantity to detect small index subfactors. So I want to imitate the Belinda-like equations relating S matrices and fusion rules. Okay? So to make the story short, what in the end I need to do is to find these two intertwiners, which are central in some sense. Okay? Okay, so let me tell you how this actually will find. So this will actually find by playing a stagmatic representation of these intertwiners, much in the spirit of planar algebras. So I want to give you an example in the case of A equal to 2. Okay? So A equal to 2, I have this 1, 2, 3, 4. So on the top, I have 4 endomorphisms composed. And on the bottom, I'm missing one. This should be a half, 4 of them. And in the middle, I have some automorphisms with the property that square to identity. Okay? So this is the intertwiners I find. Okay? I claim that these intertwiners have the desired central property. Okay? So I'm going to check using diagrams that this T is central on the subalgebra of self-intertwiners of the top part. Now, such algebra is well studied. You probably have seen all those diagrams before. Okay? So, in fact, this subalgebra is generated by braids. Okay? So for A equal to 2, you have the Femina kind of leap algebra with cups and caps. Okay? And A equal to 3, it's also known that this algebra is generated by those braids. All right. So how do I check that these braids are central? So I need to check these two relations, okay? Because perhaps I should also put this part here. So I put a braid here. I want to show that braid comes down. Okay? So there's one braid here, and there's one possible braid here. This one is similar to the first one. Okay? So I need to check for the braid here and here. That's it, because this one is similar to this one. Okay? So the two types of braids to consider, and I want to show that this braid can come down. Okay? But you need to see that this is elementary because this is a two-dimensional space. Okay? It has only two projections. Okay? This unitary operator has to map projection to projection. Okay? And it has to preserve the trace, the Markov trace. And there's only one possibility. So it has to map one braid to another braid. Okay? And the same argument works for N equal to 3. Okay? Thank you.